Land and culture questions we haven't really...
Yeah, that's what I was about to go to. I just wanted to make sure that...
You had a nicely phrased question.
There was trends regarding agriculture in New Mexico, but then there was also a little about the connection between land and culture.
I'm not... You know, if you want the trends in the agriculture in New Mexico, you should really talk to the Quivira Coalition. Because
mm-hmm.
they have their act together, I think.
Yeah.
And actually, they invited Barry last... year to come. And I discovered Wendell Berry as a senior at Dartmouth, and I read him for an education class. And it's one of these little books that sat in my mind and then grew over the years. So when I went back to graduate school in 1986 at Northwestern, what did I want to study? I really wanted to study rural communities' relationship with the environment and how those could be sustainable. And that's how I ended up looking at Latin American political economy of Latin American and development, because those are the key questions. But he came back last year to Albuquerque and actually shook his hand afterwards and said, thank you very much for really changing my life. But he's such a nice, modest guy. He was kind of sheepish. But he's brilliant to listen to. And the irony is I heard him right before I heard Jeffrey Davidoff say these ridiculous things about Mexico. Jeffrey Davidoff also said quickly that in terms of biofuels, that really one great development opportunity for developing countries are sugarcane production to use as ethanol, essentially food for fuel. And then asked about American corn for the same purpose, he didn't think that was a good idea. So it's all right for developing countries to use food for fuel because they don't need to eat very much. But in this country, no, our corn, we need our corn for the Nebraska Cornhusker football team, I think is what we need.
What is the building that they... in South Dakota or North Dakota that they do a whole building out of corn. They make miracles out of corn on a building. That's what corn's for.
So
the connection between... Could you talk a little bit about the connection between land and culture?
This is something I've thought about a lot because I'm not an anthropologist, not even a sociologist. I'm a political scientist. But I'm a political scientist who went into the field, so you encounter a lot of other questions that you're not really trained for. But I didn't go into the field asking about cultural issues. I went into the field and asked about how many cows you had or how many hectares you grew. And so you pretty quickly discover the relationship between a people's economy and their culture and who they are. And it's not completely deterministic, meaning that if you put people in one place, they might develop a culture that's related to that place, and some other people might develop a different culture. So, for example, you have the Hopi and the Navajo, who have two quite different cultures, although they live in the same place. Hopi live in relatively urban enclaves, and the Navajo like to live in hogans far out from everyone else. So you have two different responses, two different cultural responses to the same kind of environment. But that's still conditioned on the environment, and it's still conditioned on the place. So, for example, when I talk about how it's really the relationship with everyone else conditioned by the relationship of the place, in New Mexico, we get these thunderstorms. If the thunderstorm rains on your farm and you have a great crop, and it doesn't rain on my farm and I don't have a good crop, if we think short term, you'll just keep your crop and I'll starve to death. But next year, you might not get the thunderstorm. So because of our connection to the place, it becomes self-evident that we need to be able to cooperate with each other. Not compete, but cooperate. When I was working in Chihuahua, Mexico, in the Sierra Tarahumara, which is very similar ecologically to New Mexico, actually, the Tarahumara have a word called corima. And corima, by the Mexicans there, is sort of what they see as asking for a begging, a limosna. And because they have very Catholic heritage, they say, okay, fine, I'll give you something. They don't judge you as not having been Protestant enough to have worked your way up. It's your own fault, you're dirt poor. No, Catholics have a little bit of forgiveness in this aspect. I'm not saying Protestants don't forgive people, don't get me wrong. But corima is seen as just someone begging. And when I asked a Tarahumara man, one of my contacts there, Felipe Martin, how he would translate corima into Spanish, he said, pues Roberto, It means every man has a right to ask for help. That's what Korima means. And that's part of the Tarumara culture. And it's, I see it as conditioned as a response partially to their environments. Now, your culture then, I think, is developed by how you have learned to live off the land and how you have developed relationships with your other people in terms of living off the land. It's interesting then what happens when that economy changes. And it's really another reason why I wanted to study Mexico, because when I was studying Mexico at the time, it was when we were trying to pass the free trade agreement. Because we have what we call the Washington Consensus. We have this idea that our economic model will work for everyone without the recognition that it is the economic model, from my perspective, that conditions your culture. So by shifting someone's economy, we're actually saying, oh, and we want your whole culture to change too. Which is not very democratic, actually. So we call ourselves the greatest democrats in the world, but simply because of our economic imperialism, we're actually undermining people's self-determination all over the world every day with what we're doing with our economy. It's interesting, though, looking at indigenous peoples, what happens when that economy is taken away from them? Because I talked to one woman who I classify as a limousine liberal who just didn't understand why, you know, why don't the Navajo just, you know, get jobs in cities and then go home on weekends and have their dances? And, you know, for people whose idea of culture is what you eat and what you dance, which is a pretty shallow idea of culture, I guess that would make sense to her because she doesn't see any economic aspect of culture. For me, when I look at indigenous peoples in the United States and around the world, I always try to see what kind of relationship they have and what type of economy they're building. And the amazing thing to me is how people, generations after their economy has been destroyed, can still maintain that culture which grew up and which developed as part of the relationship to the land. I grew up in Napa, California, and when I grew up in Napa, California, I didn't see any Indians around. There were no Indians around. But last year I sent a student to Point Reyes National Seashore, just north of San Francisco, just about an hour away from Napa, and she was dealing with the Indians there, the American Indians, who had that as their national, but not as their national, as their ancestral homeland. Now, this is a tribe that had been terminated in the 50s and then reconstituted themselves in the 90s and then got an official sanction as a tribe in early 2000s. And they're still there. I don't know how they've done it. This is like, for me, the great untold story of American culture is how these peoples have managed to maintain that culture, disconnected from the economy and disconnected from the land. And how we might be, and I think, you know, would be the greatest thing in this country if we could try to manage to reconnect those people, allow them to reconnect themselves to both their place and their local economy. That's my non-anthropologist riff on culture.
That was good.